Welcome to Water Talk. We had a really generative conversation with Dr. Kutcha Risling-Baldy that we broke into two episodes, and we're so pleased to bring you the second part of our discussion about decolonizing water today. As we're all probably feeling, we're entering another dry year here in California, and there was a lot of discussion about water for the environment, water for fish, and a lot of those are really salient themes in talking with Dr. Risling-Baldy.
The other thing that I loved about this episode, and I think that people should listen for, is just kind of this question of, you know, why not start with just, you know, visioning and considering, what if we gave land back and water back to Indigenous people to manage? And starting first with that question and then kind of proceeding from there. And I really like that frame of starting with a question and then kind of starting to think about what could be possible without immediately thinking of all of the barriers or logistical issues with doing something. Is to first just have that vision. And yeah, I really enjoyed Kutcha's visioning in this episode, and just actually it throughout our whole conversation.
You know, I think in this one, I would like that that our audience notice also how, as we're grieving once again the drought and how we're going into all of these now new, once again, our ways back to save water and so on. This is, I would say, not necessarily a perennial, but with many centuries of griefs of this indigenous community for the river and the fish and their way of living. Listen how Kutcha is talking about this ecological grief. And how it's important for their lifestyle, their culture, and the traditions that they have in there. As they have this direction, they oriented themselves by the river. Is that important? It is also so important for their cultural activities. And think of this, or please relate our audience to some of those.
One of the things that has been striking me is that, you know, we're entering this dry year again. And I think that more and more people are talking about it, not so much as a temporary situation, right? There's people arguing that we need to not be calling it drought even anymore, that there's aridification.
I was going to say, Faith, I was curious. I noticed you said dry year twice. And I was just like, Faith is not saying the word drought. What's that about?
Well, because I think that the term drought is one that's overused. And one of the things that I've been pushing for a lot is we really have to be more specific when we're talking about drought anymore, because California in a certain way is always in drought. If you look at it from a sort of just water supply perspective, there will always be people who feel like there's not enough water here. And then there's the actual sort of meteorological drought, climatological drought, and all of these things have different meanings, socioeconomic drought. And then there's this climate change context in which people are now talking about aridification. So I'm originally from Arizona, and the Southwest has been in essentially a 20-year drought. At what point do you begin to stop calling that drought and sort of call it the condition? I don't love the terminology of new normal, but just this process of an aridifying climate system where it's just getting drier and hotter. And so as we think about these sort of a lot of the trade-offs that have already been made around water and how those will intensify into the future, I do feel like Kutcha presents this very interesting and straightforward way of thinking about how we might think about that topic differently. So without further ado, please listen to part two of our conversation with Dr. Kutcha Risling-Baldy. You wrote this beautiful book called We Are Dancing for You that centers on the revitalization of women's coming of age rituals, particularly within your own Hoopa Valley tribe. And water plays a significant role in ritual and really all of life for your tribe, as you were just talking about. Can you tell us a little bit more about the work for your book?
Yeah, I mean, so the book really is about the ways in which our community worked to revitalize our women's coming of age ceremony. And it reviews for people historically why it was that our women's ceremony was particularly targeted for eradication. And even though for a period of time, there was a time when we might not have done it as publicly, or we didn't really do it very often as a result of colonization, it never left like our community imagination, our cultural imagination, and our elders were very clear that they really wanted it to return. And so it's about that revitalization, and it talks about like, what does revitalization and resurgence look like in this time that we're in right now? And what have we been able to do to show it as a praxis of decolonization? How do we push back against all the things that are sort of internalized and pushed down on our young people? It's a really beautiful story about our community coming together to say, it's Native women and girls that we need to uplift and uphold, and then seeing the impact of that. So I'm able to interview the young women who have gone through that. The stories that I've been able to tell outside of that, that are really important in regards to water is there was a period of time in 2002, there was like a massive fish kill in our region as a result of the continued seizure of water by the Klamath dams that were happening. And so the Klamath River was very, very sick. The salmon got really sick, and thousands upon thousands of salmon died on the shores of the Klamath River. And when you see that as an Indigenous person who grew up with this river as so centered to who you are and salmon too, it's a devastation. It's a devastation that like I can't really describe, because the question that I think a lot of Indigenous scholars have asked is like, well, how do you mourn the loss of a river, the loss of salmon? But there's a palpable mourning in our communities because of this. It was a reminder of the sort of, the perilousness of what is happening in our communities with settler colonialism. And I think a lot of that was internalized by our young people because they had to watch our elders go through that. And I always use the example of my own grandfather, who is like the strongest man. He was the strongest man alive, right? He's since passed away, but just, he was Superman. We actually used to be like, he's like Superman. And watching him look out at what was happening in our community and crying and saying to me, what does this mean for our future? What's happening? And is there any way out of this? And I think to get people really invested in what dam removal was, it's to show you that like we're watching thousands of fish die. Well, fast forward to a few years later. And one thing that Indigenous peoples in our region did because of that is like now we employ all of these scientists, and their job is to like watch and do the monitoring of the river so that they can see what's the conditions and what could happen for the salmon. So we took upon our relationship. We were like, we're responsible for these salmon. Nobody else is doing it, but we have to make sure this never happens again. So they monitor all of the conditions of the river. And at one point they figured out, they were like, the same conditions on the river exist right now that existed during the fish kill. And if we continue in this way, this is the exact same situation, and we can't have that happen again. So they went to the Bureau of Land Management at the time, and this was during Obama's administration. And they said, we need more water, because if we don't get more water, a bunch of fish are going to die. We have all the scientific evidence. We have everything we need. You're setting yourself up for a fish kill. And the Bureau of Land Management said to the tribes, we can't do anything until you find a dead fish. So the minute you find a dead fish, let us know, and then we will send you more water. And the scientists pointed out like, okay, so it takes like 3 days for the water to actually get to us. And so by the time we find like a dead fish and then you send down the water, it's likely not going to save any of the fish. And so everybody started, they were like, what are we supposed to do? And we actually, as Indigenous peoples in this region, started walking the rivers looking for dead fish. Because we were like, that's the only way that they're going to listen to us. And at the same time, the Hoopa Valley tribe organized a protest at the top of the dam, which is in Lewiston, which feeds into the Trinity River. They brought the tribal members on a bus to the dam. And they were like, we're here to call attention to the fact that if we don't get water, our fish are going to die. And it's going to do the same thing. And we need the water. So I started tweeting a lot. Actually, the hashtag we used at the time was release the dam water. And we were like tagging the Bureau of Land Management. We were tweeting everybody, taking pictures. But the really beautiful thing is these girls who had been through this ceremony, they recognized that if the water was sick, and at the time it was testing at levels where the algae was so high that it was toxic, they always say, it's really interesting the way they put it. They always say, like, don't let your animals drink the water. It's toxic. But they never say, like, human beings are at risk. They're just like, don't let your animals. But we're like, I assume that means us too. And they're like, well, I mean, we don't know about that, but we know don't let your dogs drink the water, right? So they're unwilling to be like alert. So we knew the river was toxic. And what the young women pointed out was, if the river is toxic, then when we do this ceremony, we can't go in the river. And we have to, as part of this ceremony, we have to go in the river. So you are like effectively stopping this ceremony from happening, and you are disconnecting us from our community, and you are causing these massive problems, because these are the things that help these young women to be able to do all kinds of things in the world, right? When we're talking about like our suicide rates or what's happening in our schools, these are the things that help them. So they were like, that's wrong. So they showed up at this dam, and in a, like 109 degree weather, they sang on top of the dam their coming of age songs. And they basically were like, if you can't give us our water, this is what you're losing. And this is so important to us. And these are all young women, like 13 to 17, 18 years old. And that to me showed me where you see how important this connection through ceremony is, because they felt a responsibility to that river. And they showed up and they were like, this is our river and we are connected to it. And I know it makes an impact in my life, and I can't think about other generations not having that because the river is toxic. And as a result of that protest, they did release water into the Trinity River to try to stave off what was a fish kill, and it didn't happen. So I think that like it took all of that energy and motion to make a government system listen, but to see our young people step up because they felt so connected to the space based on all of the things that we do to connect them. That's what I think you're talking about when you're talking about the relationship, right? Like the radical relationality of what that leads to.
Yeah, thank you so much for sharing that story. One of the other sort of major issues facing all of us these days is wildfire. And in a recent interview, you had said to the reporter, if you want to support Indigenous knowledges, cultural burning, moving toward Indigenous sciences, you also have to support land return. You also have to support our sovereignty over our lands. Can you talk a little bit about efforts to return land, and relatedly, perhaps water and water rights in California today?
We compiled a report. One of my graduate students who I work with, her name's Carrie Tully, and myself, if you go to my website, you can see it under the publications. We actually compiled a report of land return in California and the ways in which multiple ways people have approached what land return looks like to Indigenous peoples. I will say this, it has been proven through like studies that land that is under the control of Indigenous peoples tends to have more biodiversity, tends to have a better forest system, tends to be more cared for, and tends to be like used in a way that people value, like in terms of it's not just being used for extractive industries. And they've shown that like across the world, if you look at where the Indigenous land holdings are. So I always say to people when they start talking about like, what does the solution to fires look like? I'm like, give the land back and everything will be better. And then people always want to point out like, but what if it's not? And I always say, look, give all the land back. And if there's a tribe that is super mean to you and like kicks you off or does something bad, you can come to my house and knock on the door and I will open it and you will say you were wrong. And then I will say, you are correct. I was wrong. And then we'll go from there. But until that time, like, just start doing it. And I know people have started. People always want an easy way that looks, but I will tell you what we've found out about land return in California, especially, is that it's looked many different ways. Private owners have given land back to Indigenous tribes. Public agencies like PG&E have given land back to tribes. Governments have given land back to tribes. City governments like have given land back to tribes. The state has started to give land back to tribes. I know that Governor Newsom recently passed, I think he did a statement or something. I forgot what it's called. It's not like an executive order, but it's like a statement where he's basically saying that this, like, state land should first be considered for return to Indigenous peoples before anything else. Like, we should be given the option of having the land returned to us. In my own region, the biggest thing that has happened in the last year has been the return of a sacred island to the Wiat peoples. So Tulawat is the center of the world, the center of the Wiat world. And as a result of a massacre in the during the Gold Rush, they were pushed off of that island. For a long time, it was privately owned, and then it became city property. And the just last year, the city of Eureka returned the island to the Wiat peoples. And this was not like a short process. Like, this was like an over 20-year process of how this could look and would look, and talking about it and educating about it. But in the end, we saw it happen last year. And I think that it was, geez, just over a year ago now. And I think that it was an amazing and beautiful moment, because I say things to people like, one, everybody in that room was so happy, and the joy and the like pure happiness that came out of that moment, that moment where you realized that the center of the Wiat world was being returned to the Wiat after 150 years. Everybody in there felt like this great sense of connection and like relief, but also like pride and then joy for what the future could look like. And in his talk, in his speech, the chairman of the Wiat tribe, Chairman Ted Hernandez, he says, at the end of his speech, he says, like, this is a really important moment, because we are going to be able to reconnect to this space that's so important to us. He's like, but what this also means is that our visions for what the future could be are possible. And he also says, like, and to me, that means the next step is all of the dams are coming down. And I was just like, yeah, that's what happens. Like, we're starting to see, and everybody starts clapping and going like, yeah, that's also possible. And I know it's possible because I've seen it. I've seen land return in my lifetime. I've seen land return in my own community. I will say that story got picked up internationally. Suddenly there was interviews going on with people from all over the world who were really excited about this possibility. As far as we know, it's the first time a city has ever returned land to an Indigenous tribe. That's incredibly important, because you're talking about a vision of a city saying that this is possible. And then the other thing being, and what I tell people all the time is, like, that all happened, I think, on like a Tuesday. It was either a Tuesday or Thursday. I think it was Tuesday, right? Like, it happened on a Tuesday. And then the next day we all woke up and it was Wednesday. And like, because sometimes I think people think, like, if we start returning land, then suddenly the whole thing's going to fall apart. And I was like, not really. We all woke up. It was Wednesday. And everything was how it was supposed to be. And we all, like, you know, like, I was like, and it was actually really beautiful, because now we know that that's happening. And I like that part of it too. Is like, and then we're like, okay, now it's theirs. So I always tell people, my first question is always, why can't we just give it back to Indigenous peoples? And that's everything. That's land. That's all the museum stuffs, right? That's all the baskets. That's all the art. That's all the everything. Why can't we give it back? Like, why can't we? There's nothing that's actually stopping us. There's things that have to be worked out, but there's nothing stopping us from having the vision of what that could be. And I always also point out to people, in the West, in the East is a slightly different story, but in the West Coast of the United States and the West Side, primarily land is owned by the federal government. So it's not even like we're saying, hey, individual people. All the time I'll do talks about land return, and then afterwards I'll get somebody walking up to me and they'll go, so you like want all of the land back? And I'm like, yeah, all of it. And then they're like, what about my house? Do you want my house? Is that, and I'll go, I'll take your house. That sounds good, right? But did you know that in the West Side of the United States, land is primarily owned by the federal government? So really, like, can we just start there? And we're talking about, in a way, the federal government thinks a lot about it as like surplus land or extra, like they're not super invested in it as like a space. Could we just start there? And when you start talking to people about that, they're like, oh, because people don't have like a concept of what that means, like land ownership, right? Like, who owns land? So to me, I'm always like, let's start there. Let's start with the federal government. Then let's start with the state government. I always point out to people, the state, and what I found out about like the city in our area, like Eureka, who I really, truly, I'm grateful. I admire them. They did an amazing thing, but they had designated this area of land as surplus land. It was not land that they were at the time invested in as usable. And part of that is because it necessitated a massive cleanup because it had been so polluted that it needed a massive cleanup in order to be used. And there was no way that they could invest in that. And so if there are cities and states that have these spaces that they're calling surplus land, why is that not being offered and given to Indigenous peoples who, with the Wiat, for instance, they were like, yeah, we still want it back. We are signing up for the long term. We're going to take care of this place. And they start cleaning it up. And over the last 10 years, have really done a massive cleanup of that area to make it a space that is less polluted. So to me, it's a win-win for everybody. And my thing is like, why not just start with the question, which is, what if we just gave it back to Indigenous peoples? And what could that look like? And it could be surplus land. It could be national parks. It could be state parks. Like, all these things are out there and I think could create really powerful possibility.
Yeah, thank you so much for that. That whole answer, I think, goes even beyond kind of the idea of hopefulness and into what it means to almost dream an impossible dream that, as you describe in the sort of Tuesday to Wednesday, somehow then becomes so possible it's almost mundane, right? Which is just a beautiful vision for the future, I think. So we always like to ask our guests if there's anything more that you would like people to know about your work and how we, the three of us and our listeners, might support your efforts.
I mean, I think the biggest thing is this summer, the Native American Studies Department at Humboldt State, we did a certificate series about California water justice and like what it looks like to both understand like the movement of California water justice, but also mobilizing for that and the ways in which Indigenous peoples need support in that. And I think it's all up on our YouTube page. And so if you go there, you can view all the talks. But I think what I learned from watching it and from being a part of it is that people are still often catching up on the history that they need to know to understand the contemporary context of where we exist today. And a lot of people don't know like the history of Klamath dams, right? They don't know like the history of water policy in California, especially. And to me, I think that that's like, and I always say to people, because everybody says, well, then we should change the curriculum, right? Like, how do you intervene on high school or how do you intervene on these spaces? And I always say to people, what I have learned primarily is when I get my students in classes and I start telling them about these issues and they all go like, why did nobody ever tell me about this before? Is that they really internalize what they learn in the fourth and fifth grade. Like, that's what they remember. So what they're talking to me about are the native things they learned in the fourth and fifth grade. And so to me, our curriculum has to recenter an idea that like we need to be having real discussions about what's happening in communities with our young people all the way through like college so that they can be ready to make the change that needs to happen. And I'll say like these YouTube videos are a way to kind of, if you're like, I don't quite know where to start with this conversation, start with the community members who are doing this work. They're able to really explain about why it has been so important. And the thing I also like to remind people about with water policy, especially, is we often think about it as like a use policy. We rely on statistics for that. And so it's sort of like, what are we looking at water usage wise? But when we think about Indigenous communities, so we are the communities really most affected by water policy in terms of water that's being used from our communities to support other areas. Primarily the agricultural industry, like we have to name it because we start to think like it's people. And I kind of hate that we get this messaging that like, if everybody took shorter showers, we'd be in a better position. If everybody, you know, and I'm like, no, like we could all take really short showers, but until we make different decisions about what we do with our agricultural industry, it's not really going to make much of a difference. We have to think about this in the, like, in terms of we are upholding an industry that maybe is using too much water and that we have to think about it differently. And that's okay, like to have radical imaginations about what that looks like. But I will say what people tell me is all of this is brand new information. And so I encourage people to take the time to watch the videos, to learn from people who are putting this information out there, that's a really good place to start. And then when we can, start to have a conversation that's based on like a knowledge of history, I think it changes what people understand when we walk into rooms and we're like, this is who we are as Indigenous peoples. This is what's going on in our communities. What I love about Indigenous movements is like, we're not saying water to save us, to protect us. We're saying everybody needs water. If you spill oil into your water because your pipeline breaks, if you dam up the water and you can't get in it or use it or drink it, that's going to affect everyone. This is about everyone. And it was the same thing with like when we were talking about our world renewal ceremonies or the things that we do in the water. We're not just doing those for our peoples. That's for the whole world. And so I think to think about it as like, when we come into spaces, we're not like, what's the most beneficial for our tribe or our peoples? We're like, this is something we should all care about. The state of our water, that's going to make a big difference in how we're able to live in the future. And we all have to think about that together.
Thank you for listening to the Water Talk podcast. I'm Faith Kearns with the California Institute for Water Resources in the UC Division of Ag and Natural Resources.
I'm Molly Kanoko, a cooperative extension specialist in soil plant water relations and irrigation management at UC Davis.
I am Samuel Sandoval, a professor and cooperative extension specialist in water resources management at UC Davis.
Water Talk is supported in part by the UCANR Renewable Resources Extension Act. If you enjoy our show, please be sure to subscribe, rate, and review wherever you listen to podcasts. Check out our website for transcripts and resources for each episode. Audio editing by
Claire Bjork, fourth year environmental policy analysis and planning major at UC Davis.
Victoria Roberts, third year student of sustainable agriculture and food systems at UC Davis.
Theme music by Sahana and Samarth Rao.